Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we start the show by talking everything you need to know about colonoscopies, and we'll be covering general gastrointestinal health issues as well with our guest, Dr. Nadeem Salfidi. He is a gastroenterologist with the Mayo Clinic Health System. He practices in Bloomer and Eau Claire. And Dr. Salfidi has an interest in digestive disorders. So as we talk with the doctor, I hope you'll join in as we talk colonoscopies, or maybe you have a general question about GI health. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Salfidi, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. You're most welcome. Thank you for having me on.
When should we get our first colonoscopy, and how often should you get them?
That's an excellent question. The first thing to consider is whether or not there is a family history of colon cancer, or whether you would be considered average risk for colon cancer. Mm-hmm. If you're somebody who does not have a family history of colon cancer or of what we call an advanced adenoma or a larger type polyp or a more dangerous type polyp, then you. The current guidelines recommend beginning at the age of 45. And if you undergo colonoscopy at the age of 45 and there are no findings at that colonoscopy, then it's every 10 years.
Okay. And actually, John in Wanakee has a question relating directly to this. John, hi.
Hello, Larry.
Yeah, what's on your mind, John?
Okay, I'm a 78-year-old male, no history in the family of colon cancer. I've had several Cologuard tests. I'm on Eliquis, and I've avoided a colonoscopy at my age, wondering when I cannot have to worry about taking the tests anymore.
So when's the last time, Dr. Salfidi?
Yeah, another great question. That is definitely a question that I get asked all the time. the current guidelines suggest that everybody should get screened up until the age of 75. And then after 75, between 75 and 85, then it's really between the person and their doctor. They can discuss whether it makes sense to keep going or not. It depends on whether or not they've ever had screening before and if they've had any positive findings before. And again, of course, the family history question as well. And also just in how healthy that person is and whether it's whether it's worth keeping going with screening. So basically, up to 75, everybody should get screened. Between 75 and 85, it's a good question to discuss with your doctor to see if it makes sense to keep going or not. And then after 85, for sure, no more routine screening.
How common are colorectal cancers among the general populations?
Another great question. Colon cancer is the second most common cause of cancer death in the United States for both men and women, and it is the third most commonly diagnosed cancer in both men and women. The most recent data that we have, between 2011 and 2015, the cases of colon cancer for men were 40. There were 46 cases per 100,000 people, and it was 35 cases for every 100,000 people in women.
Hmm. Mary in Pewaukee has something again relating, I believe. Let's go there. Mary, hello.
Yes, hello to you and the doctor. Longtime supporter of WPR here. And I did want to say that people are getting cancers earlier, as I'm sure the doctor knows, and thank you very much for what you do. My daughter had her typical colonoscopy at the age of 50 last year. They did find rectal cancer. They did fortunately was in stage one, but if she would have gotten it earlier, as is happening, she could have been in stage two, three, four by the age of 50. So I have heard that, and you can concur or deny, doctor, that people are getting cancers of this type earlier and earlier. I think different kinds of cancer. And also that the Surgeon General just mentioned something about, or actually put out the information earlier this year about alcohol and cancer.
Hmm.
So, well, first of all, thank you for sharing that, and I'm sorry to hear about your daughter, but I'm glad it seems like it's going to be okay for her. You do bring up an excellent point, which is yes, that the incidence of colon and rectal cancer has increased in the younger population, in those younger than the age of 50, and that is one of the reasons why over the last few years. They have reduced the age to start screening from 50 to 45. And so now we are seeing more and more people at the age of 45 presenting for their first colonoscopies.
Mm. Mary, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. What are the known causes of colon cancer?
So the risk factors for colon cancer still do include age. Age is still considered the biggest risk factor. So it definitely the incidence of colon cancer does go up as we age. The other biggest risk factor is family history and sort of a genetic predisposition. In terms of the actual cause of colon cancer, the way we believe it is that certain changes happen in the DNA of the cells that line the colon, that are referred to as mutations, take place over time. And if you have enough of these mutations, eventually you have abnormal growth, which is typically a polyp, and then over time that polyp can then become a cancer. What sets it off? Again, we don't know for sure, but as mentioned, there are different risk factors, including age, any sort of underlying genetic predisposition. Those are the two biggest ones. In terms of sort of things that you can do that are under your control, some of the risk factors include both smoking and alcohol. Both have been associated with an increased risk of colon and rectal cancers. Obesity is another one. And then we do think that there are some dietary things that can be both protective as well as increase the risk. In terms of those that we think may increase the risk of colon cancer, the main one is consuming large amounts of red and processed meats. And then in terms of things that are considered more protective, sort of what we would consider a good diet, are things like eating a diet high in fruits and vegetables, a diet that's high in whole grains, a diet that's high in lean proteins, such as, white meats, fish, et cetera.
Athena in Mesa Mani has a question. Hi, Athena.
Yes. For someone in their 70s who's had a really good colonoscopy report ever since their 40s or 50s, whatever, who has strictures from diverticulosis, no evidence of polyps or anything, any problem in any of those colonoscopies for cancer or anything like that, and no family history, what can they do to ease their struggles with this? Thank you.
I apologize. So if I'm understanding, do you feel like you've had some symptoms related to recurrent diverticulitis and strictures? Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
That's an excellent question. In terms of evaluating diet and diverticulosis and diverticulitis, the only good evidence we have is again, to try to increase the consumption of diets that are high in fiber, sometimes taking a fiber supplement such as psyllium husk can also help. Otherwise, I definitely would recommend that you talk to your doctor or be seen by a gastroenterologist to kind of review that and to have your history reviewed in more detail to see if there's anything that can be tailored to you.
Well, I'm just wondering, besides colon cancer, what else can doctors use colonoscopies to diagnose?
Yeah, for sure. So, colonoscopy is used for screening for colon cancer, as you mentioned, but then it's also used for a variety of diagnostic purposes. One thing that I always like to make sure that I point out is that if you're having symptoms such as unexpected weight loss, if you're seeing blood in your stool or rectal bleeding, if you're developing new abdominal pain or you are having a radical change in your bowel habits, those are all good reasons to have further evaluation with colonoscopy. Some of the things that we're looking for, of course, that we're also looking for to rule out colon cancer or big polyps that may be causing some of these problems. But also looking for some other things that can lead to these symptoms, things such as inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease, things like AVMs, which are these abnormally dilated blood vessels in the wall of the colon that can bleed intermittently from time to time. So those are kind of the two main things when we look for, when we talk about colonoscopy. One is for screening, and then the other is for diagnostic purposes. And again, to kind of review some of the symptoms that I just mentioned,
yeah,
and to have those evaluated further.
Marianne in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I just had my first colonoscopy in my late 50s. I had used Cologuard until that time. And after the colonoscopy, I was told that they found three minor polyps. One was of a type that could become cancerous, but I do have a family member. My paternal grandmother died of colon cancer. My question is, how often should I have colonoscopies at this point going forward? And secondly, if I were the fortunate person to develop colon cancer, how would you find that and treat that? Is that still a promising cancer to address?
Okay.
Thank you for the questions. To address the colon cancer question, the most common way to diagnose a colon cancer is through colonoscopy. The vast majority of colon cancers are found at the time of colonoscopy. You see them when you do the exam, and then you take biopsies that are then reviewed in pathology to confirm whether what you're seeing, the tumor that you're seeing, is in fact a colon cancer. Treatment of colon cancer depends on the stage. One of the rationales for screening is to try to catch colon cancer at an earlier stage when it's a little bit more easily treated. Early stage cancer, colon cancer, is usually managed with surgical resection, surgery, just go in and take it out. Answering, how often do people undergo colonoscopy? It all depends on, what you find at the time of colonoscopy. There are guidelines. The American College of Gastroenterology has guidelines in terms of the number of, precancerous polyps found, as well as the size of those polyps, and then also what they find under the microscope when they examine them that way. So all those factor into when we recommend that you come back for a repeat colonoscopy. And once you come back, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're always coming back for that number of years. So, you know, so if you have a certain number of polyps and we say come back in 3 years, now at the three-year mark, if we repeat the exam and we're not seeing any polyps at that time, you may not necessarily have to then come back again in 3 years. You may be able to extend the interval longer to 5 years, say. I hope I answered those questions.
Yeah, you did very well, Dr. Dr. Nadeem Safidi. Safidi is a gastroenterologist with Mayo Clinic Health System. He practices in Bloomer and Eau Claire as we talk colonoscopies and other intestinal issues as well with him. You can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Our guest today, Dr. Nadeem Safidi, a gastroenterologist with the Mayo Clinic Health System, practicing in Bloomer and in Eau Claire. Great to have him with us. We're zeroed in so far on colonoscopies, taking other questions related in that area as well at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. Will emailed. He had bleeding after a recent colonoscopy and had to have another procedure to patch up a rip from the procedure. Just wonders how common is that?
Yes, thank you for that question. Absolutely. We do realize that there is a risk of post-polypectomy bleeding with colonoscopy. That risk is more so if cautery is needed to remove the polyp, and sometimes that's the case for larger polyps. The risk is about, or is less than 1% of cases.
Okay, so not real common for sure.
Right. And if I just may add that, as you can imagine, that risk does go up a little bit if somebody needs to be on blood-thinning medications such as warfarin or Eliquis.
The colonoscopies themselves, it can be a little bit time-intensive when you include the preparation for the exam. What are the pros of this? I think the pros and cons, if you look at the pros of it, there's quite a few because you're going to get a pretty good indication of where you are when it comes to cancer.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you for that question. Yeah, I agree. I mean, the biggest pros, of course, are, you know, the thing about colonoscopy is that it can are we trying to catch colon cancer early? We're also trying to prevent colon cancer altogether. You know, we believe that the vast majority of colon cancers begin as polyps, either adenomatous polyps or the other type of polyp are called sessile serrated adenomas. But the vast majority of cancers start that way. And so if we're able to complete a good colonoscopy, good quality colonoscopy, and we're able to find these polyps and remove them, then by doing so, we are reducing the risk of colon cancer. And you mentioned, you know, the biggest con, of you know, or some of the cons for colonoscopy include that it is a time commitment. You do have to do a preparation the day before, and then, you know, most colonoscopies are carried out with the aid of sedation, what we call moderate or conscious sedation. And so, you know, people would have to miss a day of work and, you know, won't be able to go back to work that same day. And because they receive sedation, they won't be able to drive themselves home. They'd have to have somebody who's able to take them home after the procedure.
I think I had the last one I had was last summer. I mean, the procedure itself, you go in, I felt like I had just blinked my eye and I was done. You know, it just it was about the least, it felt the least intrusive that you could possibly get when it comes to a procedure, it was for me.
And that's fantastic. And I do feel that for the majority of people, that is the case, that they do in general have a good experience with it.
Yeah. Paula in La Crosse has something. Let's go there. Hi, Paula.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to comment because I listened regarding the individual who called about diverticulosis, diverticulitis. And I'm a retired registered dietitian of 35 years. And I think that encouraging people to increase their fiber intake is so important. But what I experience, what gets neglected, and so many patients I've worked with, they just were not drinking adequate fluids. And our bowel health, not only with fiber, is so important, but are you getting adequate fluids to help flush? A fiber isn't going to work unless it's got adequate fluid. And people get frustrated. They try to increase their fiber, and then they're bloaty, uncomfortable. And I think it's a lot because they're just not drinking adequate fluids. So I just wanted to point that out.
Oh, Paula, thanks. Do you agree with that, Dr. Salfidi?
Thank you. Yes, that is an excellent point, and that is true. With fiber, we always need to make sure we have adequate fluid intake as well. The one that I most commonly recommend is psyllium husk, and that one you do, dissolve in water. And so we try to do it that way.
Yeah. Thanks, Paula. Appreciate it. Catherine in Lacta-Flambeau, we'll go to you. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling mainly to share information. I had been diagnosed with stage 4 metastasized stage 4 colon cancer. And it started out where I thought it was a dietary problem. And I would adjust my diet so that my bowel functioning was better and things like that. Well, it turned out that when I took Cologuard and it read that I needed a colonoscopy, that because I had the markers, they scheduled the colonoscopy, and when they were performing it, they couldn't get the scope in because I had a tumor that was almost totally blocking my colon, and it had attached my uterus. Anyhow, I ended up with a double surgery that way. And so we did the medical chemo, and then I ended up with nodules in my right lung and went through all these processes with that, ended up with 5 radiations, got that cleared, and now nodules are back. But I think the main thing is to get the testing.
Catherine, thank you. A comment, Dr. Salfidi?
Catherine, I'm very sorry to hear that. I thank you so much for sharing that story. Yes, this is very important. Again, to go back to the point, we recommend screening to try to reduce the risk of colon cancer or to try to catch it at an earlier stage when it's more easily treated. And then the other point that I would also like to emphasize is that, yes, if you have any symptoms that you're noticing, anything that that is concerning, please make sure to speak to your physician to have that evaluated, including, again, just to emphasize, if you notice any rectal bleeding, if you notice any change in your bowel habits, as Catherine mentioned, any abdominal pain, unexpected weight loss, please make sure to have that checked out right away and not to delay having those checked out.
Yes. Catherine, thank you again for calling. Annie in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Say, my father died of colon cancer at 54. I'm 76, and I've had many, many polyps. The problem is I have what they call redundant colon, which means I have too much colon, and I never clean out, and I have to have 2 of the Go Lightly containers to clean out for a colonoscopy. I'm just wondering, I've never been able to get an answer about this. So I never clean out totally. Is that a problem? I mean, if I retain fecal matter in my body and it's not moving, is that going to could that cause colon cancer? I've had many, many precancerous polyps removed. And, the doctors say you don't want to have a medical procedure to do this, to, you know, rectify it. So what exactly would your suggestions be with this?
Yes, again, thank you for the question. That is not totally uncommon where we see people when we do our colonoscopies and, you know, we find that they have a redundant colon. To the best of my knowledge, you know, having a redundant colon, having difficulty with the clean out does not really increase the risk of colon cancer or colon polyps. Again, you know, the biggest risk factors do remain age as well as family history. And you mentioned that your father had colon cancer in his 50s. And so thank you for mentioning that, because if you know, with that history, we do typically recommend that you start at the age. If you have a first-degree family member who's had colon cancer or a large polyp in their 50s, then we typically recommend that you start your colon cancer screening at the age of 40 rather than 45. And if somebody has a family history of colon cancer for somebody who's in their younger than 50, then we would say you should start 10 years prior to when that person was diagnosed with colon cancer. So if you had a first-degree family member had colon cancer at the age of 45, then we would recommend that you undergo colonoscopy at the age of 35. And the one other thing just to mention with that is also that if there is a family history of colon cancer, then we typically recommend, the GI societies recommend that you undergo colonoscopy for screening rather than alternate screening methods such as Cologuard or testing for blood in the stool.
Mm-hmm. Annie, thank you for calling. What are polyps anyway?
Yeah, excellent question. Yeah, so polyps are essentially abnormal growths on the inside lining of the colon. They result from some changes in the DNA of the cells that line the colon. And over time, some polyps, not all of them, some polyps, if you leave them alone, can then eventually become colon cancer. And that's why, you know, we care about them. That's why we look for them and we take them out when we see them at the time of colonoscopy.
Yeah, I think I've had one or two that the doctor said, we snipped them. And so I expect they are fairly common.
Correct. Yes, we do see when they looked at routine screening colonoscopies, and this was before they were doing them at the age of 45, when we were more commonly starting at the age of 50, based on the previous guidelines. And at that time, they found that up to 35% of men and 25% of women had at least one precancerous polyp in their colon when they presented for routine colon cancer screening.
Bob emailed us and wonders if you could discuss virtual versus regular colonoscopies. He's never had a real one. He's 70 and will get another virtual one this year. He's never had polyps.
Great question. Yeah, so a virtual colonoscopy is where you undergo an exam of your colon by a CAT scan or a CT scan, and they do it in a way, to better look at the colon specifically. The American College of Gastroenterology says that they recommend using CT colonography in patients who either do not wish to undergo colonoscopy or in patients who have other reasons where they can't undergo colonoscopy. And typically, if there are no polyps, they recommend a CT colonography or virtual colonoscopy every 5 years. The one drawback about virtual colonoscopy or Cologuard is that it's considered a two-step process where if there's a positive finding, then the recommendation is that you then still would have to undergo colonoscopy because you have to investigate what was found that was abnormal.
So who's a candidate for the at-home screening, or who's a good candidate, would you say?
At-home screening is for people who are considered at average risk for colon cancer. So again, people who don't have a family history of colon cancer, people who don't have any symptoms that should be investigated further, or who don't have specific diseases that predispose that put them at higher risk of colon cancer. And so it's basically people who are average risk for colon cancer, who for whatever reason choose or prefer not to undergo screening colonoscopy, then those are people who are definitely good candidates for that. I think that the one point that that's always brought up is that, or two points that I'd like to make. One is it's always a good idea to talk to a screening modality for you. And number two is sort of one of the mantras is that the best screening modality is the one that's actually completed.
Yeah.
whether that's colonoscopy, whether that's Cologuard, whether that's CT colonography, it's the best one that's done. It's the one that's actually completed.
Yeah. Well, Chris says, please tell everyone to be careful with the male test that found nothing. His wife died from colon cancer after a couple of surgeries and chemo. She hadn't had the regular colonoscopies and had done the male tests that didn't seem to show anything.
Thank you, Chris, for that note. That is indeed a very important note. I'm sorry for your loss. Obviously, the first point is that none of these tests are 100%. If you undergo screening and then you develop symptoms, it's still important to have those symptoms evaluated. Don't dismiss those symptoms and say, oh, well, I had screening, so obviously it couldn't be colon cancer. If you develop symptoms that are concerning, you should always talk to your doctor to see if further evaluation is needed. That's number one. And number two, all these modalities, there's always a chance of missing something, and none of them are 100%. With regards to Cologuard, the initial studies showed that they can miss up to 8% of colon cancers. So it's definitely not a perfect screening modality.
A listener emailed us, some of us as we age may encounter more and more issues with constipation. What are your suggestions to deal with this issue that seemed to be natural? Are they natural? I don't know.
Yeah. Excellent question. Constipation, everybody has different bowel patterns. There's no such thing as, everybody should have the same bowel pattern or have the same number of movements every day. The GI societies generally consider, normal is anywhere between once every 3 days to up to three times a day. But if something is bothersome for you, then you should always have it evaluated for sure. Sometimes bowel habits can change over time, and that should always, number one, obviously, I do recommend that you talk to your doctor about it more. And number two is we always recommend to try to increase your fiber intake, as we mentioned earlier, and also to make sure that you drink enough fluids with that increased fiber intake. If you are not able to achieve it through diet alone, is to take fiber supplementation, such as psyllium husk. But if this is something that's new for you, I always recommend that you have it evaluated further and to talk to your doctor about it. And then some people end up, once they're evaluated, may need prescription medications to try to help them with their achieve a more regular bowel movements.
DJ and Spooner emailed us, have nano or microplastics been linked to increases in colon cancers? And do you know of any way to avoid these plastics?
That's a great question. I know that's on everybody's mind these days. I don't believe that there have been any studies looking at that yet, though I'm sure that they are ongoing, and we may have more data on that and more information over the next few years.
Georgia in Madison has something for us. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. When I was 21, I'm 80 now. When I was 21, I had an adenocarcinoma in my appendix, which was discovered incidental to a different surgery. And they took out half of my large bowel. And that was back in the days of barium enemas anyway. But I've had a number of colonoscopies. And the last time I had one, they said, well, you don't need to have them anymore because you're old. But I'm wondering if I was probably like 65 or 70 at that point. Is that still good advice? And how could I have a redundant colon with half of it gone?
Those are two great questions. To answer the first question with regards to, you know, when do we stop screening for colon cancer, that is very much an individualized question, an individualized answer. The GI societies do recommend everybody to continue undergoing screening up until the age of 75. Now, those who are between the ages of 75 and 85, it does depend on different factors, including that person's overall health, but also, obviously, you know, whether they are at higher risk for getting colon cancer, if they've had cancer in the past, or if they've had polyps, precancerous polyps in the past. So I would, if you are still concerned about that, I definitely would recommend that you speak to your doctor about that further and see what they recommend. In terms of the redundant colon, that can happen over time. We don't fully understand, why it happens, but for people, transit of stool through the colon, and then over time that can lead to a redundant colon.
Our guest today, Dr. Nadim Salfidi, a gastroenterologist with the Mayo Clinic Health System. He practices in Bloomer and Eau Claire. Questions for him, give a call. We're going to look at some other general common things like irritable bowel syndrome. We'll take a look. We can talk about ulcers, maybe Crohn's disease. Lots to talk about. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, we'll talk about the latest research involving eye transplants, and we'll take your questions about vision health as well. Right now, though, we're talking colonoscopy and other issues with our guest, Dr. Nadim Salfidi, gastroenterologist with the Mayo Clinic Health System, practicing in Bloomer and Eau Claire. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. In general, what are the most common digestive problems patients come to you with, Dr. Salfidi?
The most common ones that we see include gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, commonly known as GERD, with the most common symptom being that of heartburn. And then the other one is irritable bowel syndrome. And then finally, not to be confused with irritable bowel syndrome, but what we call inflammatory bowel disease. And that includes Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. I would say those are the three most common conditions that we see here in Northwest Wisconsin. And then obviously, do a lot of screening colonoscopies as well.
Yeah, of course. What is irritable bowel syndrome, and what are the symptoms?
Yeah, great question. So irritable bowel syndrome, in some ways, is a diagnosis of exclusion, though the GI societies do have a set of diagnostic criteria. But essentially, it is where people have an inconsistent bowel pattern. Sometimes it can be constipation predominant. Sometimes it can be diarrhea predominant. Then you can have sort of what's called a mixed type IBS, where they can go sort of from back and forth, from diarrhea to constipation. Typically, it's associated with some level of abdominal pain or abdominal discomfort, and where these symptoms are sort of bothersome for them. And with irritable bowel syndrome, usually we're looking to exclude other disorders such as inflammatory bowel disease. I often tell patients that with irritable bowel syndrome, we know there's something abnormal going on with the GI system. We just haven't really been able to fully find it, or at least our current sort of diagnostic modalities aren't able to fully pick it up. And so that's sort of it in a nutshell.
Yeah. How's it treated?
There's no specific treatment for irritable bowel syndrome. It's primarily we try to help people manage the symptoms. You know, it's not one of those things where you know what's wrong and you have a targeted medication, or where, you know, you can go in and just remove a part of the bowel to solve it. So primarily we're managing symptoms for the disease. The one really good news about irritable bowel syndrome is, you know, as far as we know, it doesn't increase your risk of any sort of bad outcomes in terms of, you know, it's not associated with an increased risk of, you know, colon cancer or other such problems.
And let's take ulcers for a minute, too. Sometimes I've said, oh, boy, this is giving me an ulcer, but, you know, metaphorically, not really, but how can you tell if you have one?
That is a great question. So, yes, you can have symptoms that are suggestive of an ulcer for sure, though some people may have an ulcer and not know it. They may not necessarily develop symptoms until something changes. But, you know, the most common symptom if people are to have a symptom from ulcer is abdominal pain that's related to eating. And it's usually a higher up abdominal pain. So it's sort of sitting above your belly button, just under your rib cage. So we call it the epigastric area. And that's typically where the pain is going to be. Most commonly, it's described as a burning pain, though that's not always the case. And sometimes people may notice loss of appetite from ulcers as well, depending on exactly where they're located. Sometimes ulcers can present because they can bleed. And so sometimes people will notice that their stools have changed, either where they're seeing blood in the stool or they're seeing sort of very dark black tar-like looking stool. And so if you ever see that, that's also important to get that evaluated. To diagnose an ulcer is to undergo an upper endoscopy, upper GI endoscopy. So it's similar to a colonoscopy, but we're going into the upper GI tract, where we go through the mouth, down into the esophagus or food pipe, into the stomach, and then the very first part of the small intestine called the duodenum or the duodenum. And thus the stomach and the duodenum are the most common places where you may see an ulcer.
And then for treating, is there a treatment for it?
Yes. So the most common way to treat an ulcer is to go on an anti-acid medication or an acid-reducing medication, the class of medications that we call PPIs or proton pump inhibitors. They are available over the counter. Though if you're going to take them long-term, we definitely recommend that you talk to your doctor about them. Or Nexium, that class of medications, which are also then used to treat heartburn or reflux disease. And just one other thing to add about ulcers is that, you know, the two most common causes of ulcers are you can get a bacteria in the stomach called H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori. And so if we find an ulcer, we'll also take biopsies in the stomach to look for that bacteria. And if we find it, then we treat to get rid of the bacteria. And the other common cause of ulcers is to take medications such as ibuprofen, naproxen, Aleve, Advil, that class of medications, aspirin. And so if we see those and we don't find H. pylori, then we, you know, obviously recommend stopping those, reducing them, and then also taking the acid blocking medication.
Mm. Phil in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm 80 years old, and a year ago I had a colonoscopy because I had precancerous polyps, and I've been getting them every 6 months. Well, 4 days later, I had an artery burst. I lost about a third of my blood and had emergency colonoscopy repairing that artery, and they're calling me to say I should get another one, and I'm a little reluctant at my age. I've heard also that older people have a thinner wall and are more vulnerable to ruptures after a colonoscopy.
All right.
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's a great question. We do know that there is definitely a risk of bleeding after colonoscopy. That's more so if you have a polyp removed, even more so if it's a bigger polyp or cautery was needed to remove the polyp. We think the risk is about 1% of cases where people present with bleeding the way you mentioned it after colonoscopy. And I understand your hesitation for wanting to go back in for another colonoscopy. You know, that's definitely a question that I would recommend that you talk to your doctor as well as to the gastroenterologist who did the procedure and talk to them and kind of review in more detail about whether or not you wish to undergo a repeat colonoscopy. Obviously, for any medical procedure that we do, there are always risks and then there are benefits. And it's always up to the individual person and then, with them to decide with their doctor whether they feel that, the benefits of undergoing the procedure outweigh the potential risks. And so that's definitely, it's always a difficult question to answer. And it's one that is unique to every person. And they sort of have to make that decision for them with the help of their doctors, of course.
Phil, thank you for calling. You mentioned earlier, Dr. Salfidi, acid reflux is something common. What causes it and how do we treat it?
Thank you. Excellent question. So what causes acid reflux is, what happens is at the bottom part of your esophagus or food pipe, there's a sphincter called the lower esophageal sphincter that connects the esophagus to the stomach. And then that sphincter usually sits closed. And when we eat and drink, it relaxes to allow food and liquid into the stomach. And then it contracts again to prevent what's in the stomach now from going back up into the esophagus or to reflux. The stomach produces acid and it sits in an acidic environment. And the esophagus is not used to an acidic environment. And so people who have reflux disease, what happens is you have essentially inappropriate relaxation of that sphincter that now allows for the contents of the stomach to go up or reflux into the esophagus. And because they're acidic, the esophagus, in a sense, doesn't like that. And for many people, it can produce symptoms, the most common one being heartburn. In terms of treatment, there's two main ways to treat. One is dietary and then sort of what we call lifestyle modifications. And then the other one is simply to go on an acid reducing medications such as, Nexium or Prilosec or Pepcid, those types of medications that reduce the acid in the stomach. Those medications, obviously, they don't stop the reflux. The reflux is still going to happen. It's just that now by reducing the acidity, the reflux may not be as bothersome to people. Terms of the lifestyle go ahead if you have a follow-up question.
Oh, no, we're about out of time. We got into it a little bit, Dr. Salfidi, but I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did as well. Thank you so much, and we'll talk some more about acid reflux the next time you're on. Thank you very much. We are going to be taking a look at your eyes next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to your eyes, eye health, and the latest in vision loss research. Some good news here to report, and certainly a way to get your questions relating to eye health answered. Our guests, two doctors who are also professors in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Science at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We have Dr. Robert Nichols. He's been studying whole eye transplantation for more than a decade. Dr. Nichols, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also with us, Dr. David Gam. Dr. Gam directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at UW. And Dr. David Gam, welcome back to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Tell us how you're experiencing vision loss, or maybe you have some questions about improving your vision. Maybe you have some questions about the research that's going on. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. You know, I've got to tell you guys a little story. It was about 20 years ago. I was teaching a writing class, and for an exam, I had to come up with a set of facts to present for the students to read and then write a story on. And I wanted to think up something that they wouldn't have any access to other information on the spur of the moment. So I thought, I wonder, I could write one about whole eye transplants. So this is about 20 years ago. So I wrote a set of facts, facts, end quote, off the top of my head, and presented in this in-class exam. And afterwards, the student said, "Is this real? I mean, are they can they really transplant a whole eye?" And I said, "Not that I know of." And I didn't think it was possible. So it sounds like it might be, possible, Dr. Nichols.
Well, first of all, I'd really like to see that set of facts that you wrote.
They don't closely, and believe me, they don't closely align with what you're doing, I don't think.
Whole eye transplant. So that goal has been sort of circulating around the research community for about 100 years, I think. And it's been impossible to do until now. We think that there are certain technologies that are in place and have advanced far enough that if we could find a way to put it all together and try it to see how successful we can be to do it. And that involves a lot of different steps, Larry. It's whether you can transplant an eye and have it live, whether the retina inside the eye is going to survive that process. And then paramount is whether you can regenerate your optic nerve, because you've got to get that reconnection back into between the eye and the brain. And that business of survival and regeneration are our greatest hurdles that we have to overcome.
So you've been working on this. I mean, how optimistic are you?
Oh, well, I have an analogy that right now we are optimistic that, you know, the analogy is like in human flight. And if we consider vision to be like an F-35 fighter jet, and you go back in the history of flight, I feel like in our program now, we're just starting to scratch that surface. And we're trying to build the glider, or maybe get to the point of building the Wright Brothers aircraft in the next 6 years.
Well, that's pretty good.
It would be a tremendous breakthrough, yes.
Oh, I could imagine. I mean, would this be something that, say, a blind person might be able to have an eye?
Yes.
That's the hope.
That is the hope. It's how well they're going to be able to use that eye. We really have to get off the ground on that, to use my flight analogy, I guess. But if we can get a person to a point where they can start to see things like whether a door is open or the difference between a knife and a fork, that sort of thing, if we can get to that groundbreaking event, then things will accelerate well beyond to full restoration. Maybe not in our lifetime, but certainly within our lifetime, we hope to have a functioning, you know, visual unit.
It's amazing. Well, here, Dr. Gam, we have more than 70,000 Americans who donate their eyes after death each year. How are the donated eyes commonly used?
That's a great question, because I imagine a lot of folks out there are saying, there are eye donations all the time. I might even have that checked off on my organ donor list. So what's the big deal? What are we doing this for? And the short answer for that is that while you donate the eye, the only part that's used to treat patients is the cornea. So that's the clear dome that covers the colored part of the eye, or the iris. And so that structure is removed, and in individuals that have irreversible damage to their own corneas, they can receive that new cover, that new dome. And that's been around for a very long time. It's a very successful surgery. It's used for a lot of different conditions. But the reason why it works and it's been around so long is that it doesn't have any other connections. So it's essentially like putting a new windshield on. So it's got cells in it. Those cells have to be happy, but there are no blood vessels in it, or there shouldn't be any blood vessels in it. And so simply taking the old damaged one off and putting a new one on and sewing it in place works. Not so with a lot of the other parts of your eye, which are connected by, in the case of the optic nerve, 1.2 million little tiny wires that pass through an area about the size of an eraser head. And so the complexity of trying to connect that so that brand new big eye, the whole eye, can actually connect with the brain, which does the seeing, is a lot different than just putting a tissue on the front of the eye.
Yeah, I remember in that test question involved the optic nerve, and there was a miraculous discovery as to how to attach that nerve, as I recall it now that you talk about it. And cornea transplants, well, you're looking at somebody who's had a cornea transplant. I've had a cornea transplant from someone from northern Wisconsin, I am very, very grateful and very, very happy that person had donated their eyes to eventually help me out. So it's a wonderful thing to happen. What are the biggest? Well, before I do that, we have a caller online with a question. So before I launch again here, let's go to Mary in Eau Claire. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind, Mary?
Well, I think this may be somewhat unusual. I had cataract surgery maybe about 5 years ago, and then the one eye got cloudy, and I heard that you could have laser surgery to correct that. So I had that done, and that eye is fine. The other eye, last year, it clouded up, you know, like it was a cataract again. And I made an appointment to get it fixed, you know, and it was a couple of months out. And in the meantime, it all of a sudden was better.
So it felt like it spontaneously cleared up. We lost Mary there for a minute. Dr. Gam, comment on that? Would that have happened?
Well, first of all, this person does not need an eye transplant. I will say that. So these are the things. This is within the realm of things that we can handle pretty well right now. Which and eventually we'll get back to the whole idea of eye transplant. But I will make a little bit of a segue on this and say, this brings up a great point, and that is, you know, different parts of your eye can malfunction. And to that extent, you want to replace the least amount that you can to make the person functional again. So what we're talking about in terms of whole eye transplant, and I will get to this person's question, is really devastating injuries where you have, you know, massive damage to an eye, could be from an explosion, Or it could be from damage to that optic nerve in the back of the eye, so that everything in front of it no longer really matters. So now getting back to this woman's question, it sounds like she had a cataract, which will cause your vision to be cloudy by itself, sometimes make it yellowish, blurry, had the cataract surgery done. And then after, right after a cataract surgery, you can have some swelling of the cornea. It happens sometimes, depending on how dense the cataract is. So if it happens right after a surgery, that usually clears up. Sometimes you use drops. If the eye that had a cataract surgery gets cloudy much later on, months or longer, then it can be the fact that the bag that the new intraocular lens was placed in becomes cloudy secondarily, and that can be lasered open. That's very common. In the case of the second eye, where she says it was cloudy and then got better, if that was in the immediate postoperative period, my guess would be that was probably just some corneal swelling from the surgery, and then that just spontaneously improved. If it was significantly later than that, it could be other things too, tear film problems, other issues with regard to the cornea, inflammation within the eye, things like that too, that we'd have to know more about her particular situation to be able to decipher.
But there's a number of things that could have happened there, at least temporarily, and then cleared itself up from the sound
Correct.
Of it. Yeah.
Correct. So, for instance, if you have your own natural lens still and you have diabetes and you have very, very high sugars, so you have a period where you have uncontrolled high sugars, your lens can swell, and then that can cause blindness that can recover after you get your sugars under control. So those are just examples that you have that kind of come and go, and oftentimes we're just trying to retrospectively figure things out.
Cassandra emailed us, is glaucoma totally in eyes or due to intracranial pressure? Cassandra's wondering, would an eye transplant recipient be able to develop glaucoma?
That is a really good question. So, yes, there's a very big effort right now to understand how the two pressures in your system affect how your optic nerve functions. And you basically, and think about it, that there's pressure inside your eye, and that's necessary. You have to have pressure inside your eye so that the light optics work properly. But there's also pressure on the other side of your eye where these neurons send their cables out through the optic nerve, and they have to work against that pressure. And a lot of people think that's the differential between the two pressures that can lead to a pathology that results in those axons not functioning properly, these cables that are coming out of your eye. And when they don't function properly, that's what precipitates the pathology we call glaucoma.
Interesting. Yeah. And Dr. Nichols, you've been involved in, or you've been studying, a cold storage system for donor eyes.
So,
go ahead and talk about that work.
Sure. So 10 years ago, I was involved in a mini consortium, not like we're dealing with now with the federal government funding that we have. And we identified the problems of doing a whole eye transplant. And basically, it comes down to these cells in the retina called retinal ganglion cells. And they're specialized cells. And, based on what they're named, they live in the retina, and they become the relay station that takes information that the retina processes when it captures light and turns it into a neurochemical signal. And they relay that information to these retinal ganglion cells. And then the retinal ganglion cells have to send that to the brain. Now, retinal ganglion cells are really, really sensitive to damage to the optic nerve, such as if you were to harvest an eye from a donor, we'd cut the optic nerve. So I was tasked with the job of taking all the understanding that my lab has on how ganglion cells respond to optic nerve damage and creating a preservative solution that would keep them alive between the donor harvesting and the recipient transplantation. So our first thought was, well, we should see what is normally used for organ transplants. And I didn't know at the time, but to our surprise, we found out that the premier solution, preservative solution for organ transplants was invented right here at the University of Wisconsin, in the Department of Surgery, and it happens to be called UW solution. And, you know, it's one of the main patents that the university has had for years and years. So we started with UW solution and we added components to it that we knew would affect the pathology of these retinal ganglion cells. And that's so far proven to be very effective at keeping an isolated eye healthy, which we hope will improve its lifespan between harvesting and transplantation.
That is very cool. What is the, what shall I say, the life of an eye? I mean, how long can you preserve one before it would need to be used?
It's a great question. Our goal was originally 24 hours. And through this agency called ARPA-H, which is funding this whole eye transplantation project, the milestone is to keep it alive for 48 hours. And we are currently doing research to that effect to see if that is obtainable.
Dr. Robert Nichols, professor of ophthalmology and visual sciences. Dr. David Gamm directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute, both, of course, at the UW-Madison. We have lots of callers online and emails as well. And it's great to have them with us here on WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guests from the UW-Madison, Dr. David Gamm, who directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute, and Dr. Robert Nichols, professor of ophthalmology and visual sciences, both in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Lots of callers online with questions. Louise in Dodgeville, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a comment and a question. I was listening to your guest talk about his research, and I was like, that is like mind-blowing and wild and so cool. So, yeah, just like fascinating. Holy cow. But my question is, my mom has glaucoma, and her medicated drops bother her eyes, so she doesn't take them, which her eye doctor said there could be possibly like a laser surgery to do, and I just wasn't really sure what that was about. So I was wondering if you could talk about that.
I can jump in on that, David, if you like.
Sure, go ahead.
So eye pressure is a real problem with glaucoma. And if it's too high, it can lead to glaucoma. It doesn't always do that, but it's definitely the main risk factor. So there are two ways to lower eye pressure. One is to reduce the amount of fluid that's being produced in the eye, which is what the drops do. And the other is to basically open the drain that allows that fluid to come out of the eye. And so there's a treatment with a laser that is directed into this drain. And originally it was tested because it thought it will just blow holes in the drain and open it up. And in fact, what it does is it changes the cellular behavior in the drain passages, and those cells do the work to open the drain up, and that causes your eye pressure to go down.
Really interesting. Louise, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Joe in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I have a question about macular degeneration, and maybe Dr. Gamm would be the person. We went to a session in Appleton a couple of years ago at Lawrence University about macular degeneration. It was excellent. And I just am calling for my friend who has macular degeneration. I went with her that day. And I'm just checking to see, is there anything new on the horizon? Is there any research that will make her condition better?
Dr. Hi,
so thank, thanks for coming to that. As you know, that was the McPherson Eye Research Institute that that sponsored that. We brought the speakers up there, including a wonderful speaker from the National Eye Institute who spoke on AMD. So the answer is yes. So around that time, we had just started getting some inklings about some new medications that could be injected into the eye that might help with the dry form of macular degeneration. So there's a dry form, there's a wet form. Actually, it's all a continuum. Everyone has dry, but some people have some swelling or some bleeding, and that causes the wet form as well. And there's been injections for that for a number of years, which are successful in a lot of individuals for controlling that kind of that wet part. But nothing had been available for folks that had the smoldering kind of forest fire underlying dry form. So these newer medications have been shown to slow that process down. Unfortunately, they have not improved vision. So you might think, well, why would I do that if it doesn't improve vision? And there are folks that raise that question. But it might be that if it started soon enough that you might be able to preserve what vision that you have. So that's one thing. In addition, there have been additional cell-based replacement treatments that have been out there in clinical trial, which have shown some promising results in slowing down the disease and perhaps even halting it for the period of time where the trials have occurred. This is not mainstream yet. It's not available. You can't walk to your ophthalmologist and say, I'd like to have one of those cell-based therapies or cell treatments. In fact, anything that you currently can be it buy or get is almost assuredly snake oil. It's something that, you know, that these so-called stem cell clinics on the corners that have popped up in a lot of different cities will tout, but have actually no scientific or medical background to them to suggest that they would work. But there is real science and real medicine coming down the pike. We have a large group here at the University of Wisconsin that's working with a number of large pharmaceutical companies to bring another cell therapy that combines both the two cell types that are lost in macular degeneration, both retinal pigment epithelium and photoreceptors, to clinical trial, which we hope will occur in the next couple of years. We anticipate that Madison will be one of those clinical trial sites.
You might mention, Dr. Gamm, as long as we're, you mentioned the McPherson Eye Research Institute does some great work. How does your research there help people and not just people who are from Wisconsin?
Yeah, so first of all, I think it's important to kind of talk about how eye research is kind of, how it's organized here at the University of Wisconsin. So we have the Department of Ophthalmology, which Dr. Nichols and myself are both involved in. That's our home department. But just like a lot of research, vision research happens all over the campus and actually beyond our campus and across the state. So there are people who work to preserve our vision and restore our vision that are in departments all across the university, of which the Department of Ophthalmology takes a lead role. The McPherson Eye Research Institute brings all those folks together under one umbrella so that we have access not just to scientists like Dr. Nichols, myself, but also engineers, psychologists, people who build machines, who work with AI, so that there's really no limit to the expertise and resources that we have available to us to tackle these big problems. And this, you know, the whole eye transplant is one of the reasons why they came to us and why Rob and I are involved in that, because the reputation of the University of Wisconsin to dream big and be able to deliver is second to none worldwide. So I think we both benefit from the fact that we have a highly collaborative environment here at UW that works together to fulfill the Wisconsin idea, which is to take what we do and bring it to the people of our state and around the world.
It's very, very cool. Lainey in Fort Atkinson, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
We have a highly collaborative environment here at UW that works together Wisconsin idea.
Lainey must have left her radio up, I think. So instead, we can hold off on her and go to Janet in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have macular degeneration in both eyes. And about 5-6 years ago, I also have cataract. And I had a cataract removed in my best eye and ended up losing my central vision. My of course, my question is, why does that happen? And it's been a long time. I guess there's nothing we can do about it. And because I do have a cataract in the other eye, too. That's getting pretty bad. And, of course, the other part of my question was probably just answered when you were talking about macular degeneration. And when eye transplant do something that would help, you know, you could do for macular degeneration if it ever comes about?
So a lot of things to unpack there, all of which I think are important. One is that, you know, we all have to step back a little bit because we have our own personal experiences, and it's easy for us to look at for causality between things like, okay, I lost more vision after I had my cataract surgery, so my cataract surgery caused my central vision to be lost. But things happen independently of themselves all the time. So I could, you know, I could get hit by a car, and that same day I could, you know, eat a pierogi. Well, that doesn't mean that the pierogi made me get hit by a car. It was kind of coincidental. So that's where we look to large studies that look at thousands of people who have cataract surgery and how does that affect their macular degeneration. And folks like Dr. Barb Blody and other retina specialists here who do work with our clinical trials unit in the Department of Ophthalmology have been parts of these very large national studies to look into this. And really there shouldn't be any fear of having cataract surgery performed, even if you have macular degeneration. And essentially, if you don't get your cataract, if your cataracts are bad, it doesn't matter what's going on behind that cataract, which is where the macular degeneration is, because you can't see through the cataract. So you need to talk to somebody who's, you know, a really good cataract surgeon. We have tons of them here at University of Wisconsin. And they need to be aware of other comorbid issues such as macular degeneration. But it's not something to be feared. So that's one question. The second one, I think, which ties into the whole eye transplant, is macular degeneration something that would be eligible for something like a whole eye transplant? And that brings in a very important nuance to all of this. And that is that macular degeneration causes the loss of one layer, the deepest layer in the layer cake that is the retina that lines the back of the eye. And so efforts to slow that process down are number one. And then efforts to replace just that layer are the next, you know, it's a significantly more complex to do that, but that would be the next thing to do. The rest of that eye pretty much is in perfect shape, including the optic nerve. So it's kind of like it's overkill to remove somebody's entire eye for something like macular degeneration and put a whole new one in, which, by the way, is not just a matter of connecting those 1.2 million wires behind the eye with the brain, but all the blood vessels that are needed to keep that new eye healthy, all the muscles, all the nerves, how do you blink? How do you do all of these things? So it's very complex. There's about, you know, there's dozens of big issues that have to be overcome to get this to work. So my short answer would be no, for macular degeneration, an eye transplant would be overkill. But we do have, as I mentioned, a lot of therapies that are currently available to patients and that are on the horizon that show great promise for folks with late-stage macular degeneration.
Janet, thank you very much for calling. Veronica in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Veronica.
Hello. Everybody answered, actually Dr. Gam answered my question, so I would just like to have a comment of being able to be one of the very lucky individuals who gets to work with him. And I will just like to say to all of the viewers of what a humble, intelligent, patient, and kind man this person is, and Dr. Gam is purely one of my heroes.
Oh,
well, I recognize your voice, Veronica, and I did not pay her.
Thank you so much, Veronica, for your comment. Appreciate it very much. The next caller is Lainey from Fort Atkinson. Let's go there. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me this time?
Yes.
Okay. I had cataract surgery a couple years ago, and for several months now, my right eye has been diagnosed as having this corneal edema, and I use drops an ointment. And there will be a timer, maybe for a couple hours, the eye will be clear. And then it gets cloudy. I shouldn't say cloudy. I can see through it, but it's like I'm looking through that old-fashioned wavy window pane glass. And at what point should I be concerned that this doesn't seem to go away and stay away?
How long have you been dealing with this?
Well, in terms of the medication, it's been about 6 weeks, but I didn't know what was going on, and I've always had trouble with light. And I was diagnosed with dry eyes. So I thought that's what was going on. Mm-hmm. But it's mm-hmm. been 6-8 months that I've been dealing with this, but 6 weeks with the ointment and the drops.
Okay. So first of all, I mean, as is always the case, it's important to be, you know, get a really thorough examination by somebody who's quite very qualified. And oftentimes we're seeing our local optometrist or our general ophthalmologist. But it's surprising, but you know, the eye is a pretty small organ, but, we in the field cut it up into a lot of different little pieces. So we have cornea specialists and glaucoma specialists and retina specialists and pediatric specialists, which is what I am. So at some point it kind of crosses over to, an area where you go like, okay, maybe some subspecialty, help is needed here. And so, you know, if you're dealing with this issue for a long time, you might ask to see one of our cornea and external disease specialists who specifically work with issues like this. And there are any number of causes to it. There's conditions called Fuchs endothelial dystrophy that can kind of erode away the inner lining of a cornea and allow fluid to flow into that. And the drops and ointments that are used are kind of high osmolarity medications that suck water out of the cornea to keep it clear, because it has to be a compact, clear tissue in order for you to see through it. If all else fails, then there are very good surgeries that can be done to either replace that inner lining or replace the whole cornea, like Larry said earlier with the cornea transplant. So there are, so I think you have a lot of arrows in the quiver for your particular condition. It's just a matter of taking it step by step, because you don't want to go way to one side and have something done that's more than what you need. And you want to give it enough time to see if it can heal itself, because that's always the best option, is if you can heal yourself. Unfortunately, as we get older, that takes longer.
It does indeed. We have an email, I think, for Dr. Nichols, and that relates to the thousands and thousands of nerve endings and vessels and so forth. To attach them sounds almost like it would be impossible. Would it have to be done surgically? Something that small, each of those individuals that small.
Yeah. So that's a really, really good question. And it really comes down to the crux of how are we going to get a whole eye transplant to work? And I'm going to let David jump in on this after I give a little brief intro. excuse me. So we're talking about a million retinal ganglion cells, and each one of them sends a little cable down the optic nerve. And when you cut the eye, you're cutting those cables. So if we can stop the pathology that is caused to the retinal ganglion cells by that cutting, because that's what happens when you damage the optic nerve. One attempt is to get those cables to regrow, I guess is the best way to say it. We call that regeneration. Now, it's a problem for mammals. If you're a fish or you're a frog, you can regrow those cables, but mammalian retinal ganglion cells don't like doing that. So there's efforts to try and stimulate the cells to basically go back in development, back in time, and regrow those axons. Now, there's also the possibility. So basically, you're not connecting those axons to the axons that were present in the recipient. Those axons are all lost. You're relying completely on the axons from the donor eye. Okay, so what we do know is if we can keep the ganglion cells healthy, that we can also keep what they still have of their cable, their proximal axon, intact. And so we can either get it to regenerate, or we can ask David's group to come up with their innovative solution. And David, I'm going to let you talk about the bridging technique.
Yeah, so this kind of is where we step in. And so my lab has been working with stem cell technology for going on 20 years now, which was originally kind of born here at UW-Madison and has evolved quite a bit. Usually what I'm doing is I'm using human pluripotent stem cells to grow cells within the retina, such as retinal pigment epithelium and photoreceptors, which are important for macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa. But we also can grow those retinal ganglion cells, which are the cells that send those 1.2 million little axons down the optic nerve. So we can grow those, and they're essentially very, very young, right out of the wrapper retinal ganglion cells. So they have the capacity to send their wires a long, long way and to make new connections. So they're basically brand new baby retinal ganglion cells, and this is what they can do. Our ganglion cells that are in our eyes have kind of lost that ability to do that. So, you know, they can't learn new tricks. And once they're severed, once they've been, you know, cut in half, they just die back. So our approach is to create what we call an eye bridge or a coupling, a biological coupling device, which is made up of these newborn retinal ganglion cells, and allow the donor eye's retinal ganglion cells to synapse or connect with these new, fresh, right out of the wrapper retinal ganglion cells, which then can take the baton and send their projections back to the brain, to the lateral geniculate nucleus, which is the first relay station within the brain. So instead of trying to make our old tired retinal ganglion cells do the work, we want to shake hands and say, we got the job, and send the new ones down that way. Now, sounds easy enough, but you know, how do you get them to connect to the exact right ones, and how important is that? So, you know, the devil's in the details, and we don't know how those details are all going to work out. But if we can make just the first little step, it goes back to what Dr. Nichols said about, you know, you got to learn to crawl before you walk, before you run. So if we can get just a handful of those new relay neurons to connect within the brain and form that connection between the donor eye and the recipient's brain, then that gives us reason to put more time and effort into it so that we can refine it, so that folks can go from maybe not being able to see any light to being able to see light and dark, which will allow you to sleep better, stay up during the day and sleep at night so you can hold a job and regain your circadian rhythms, all the way to maybe seeing motion so you're better off ambulating and crossing the street, to maybe someday having formed vision. But that's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be an iterative process.
This is just the whole thing is just amazing to me. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Dr. David Gamm, Dr. Robert Nichols, our guests today, both are professors of ophthalmology and visual sciences in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Great to have them with us as we talk about their research on eyes and looking at common eye issues with our guests. Carol in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thanks. First, I want to remind everyone to wear eye protection when they are working with anything that might fly at them. And this is because in 2018, my son had a nail ricochet into his eye, but his eye protection was on top of his head instead of in front of his eyes. But this caused a collapsed globe, which he had surgery for, and now he has a permanent scar in the center of his vision, and he really can't see out of that eye. So the doctor at the time told him that the surgery wasn't guaranteed to help him, so he decided not to do it. Now he's 24, so I'm kind of wondering, like, would the surgery be worth it? What do you think? And what are the risks versus the success rate of the cornea transplant?
Okay, so for cornea transplant. So it comes down to a very careful examination to determine what his retina looks like, right? So if you think of the eye like a camera, you've got the lens up front and you've got the film in the back. And what you're talking about is trying to replace the lens. But if the film is really bad, it doesn't matter if you got a brand new lens there or not. So you really have to have a firm idea of what is the potential of that retina, even if you had a crisp new clear cornea. So that's the part that right now we can't fix, is the damage to the retina. And that's what we're working hard here at UW to be able to address. So weighing the benefits and risks. So, okay, if you undergo this transplant surgery, well, you're going to need medications because it's still a transplant, which means it could be rejected. And things can go sideways with any surgery. Understanding what the limits are to the retina is really key in this situation, because if his biggest complaint is he has this big scotoma or blank spot in the center of his vision and it's blurry all around that, well, then the blurry all around that can be improved by a new cornea, but the central blind spot won't.
Okay, makes sense. And the drops that I take drops every day. I have a drop in the morning and a different drop in the afternoon or the evening before I go to bed is pretty minimal for given the advantages what I receive, for sure. Carol, there you go. Thank you for calling. Peggy Sue in Brilliant. Your turn. Hi, Peggy Sue.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have something to share because I never realized how important my eyesight was until I had been working at Jun's and I let a box drop out of my arms in front of me and this powder came up in my eyes. And for days afterwards, I had cloudy vision kind of in that eye and I thought, okay, something's going on here. I don't think this is good. So I went to my doctor. And she asked me to put my hand over my right eye, and my left eye did fine. I was able to read the whole chart, but when I tried to cover my right eye couldn't see a thing. It was completely blurry. Talk about scared. I hadn't cried that hard for a very long time. So I wound up at Tower Clock Center in Green Bay. Best thing I ever got sent to, I'm telling you. The Valley here is so lucky. We have so many great doctors and ortho surgeons. Oh, my goodness. But the men there have been treating me. I see a Dr. Servi who has been treating me since day one. He explained I had glaucoma, and that made me break down because glaucoma in my mind always meant blindness. And then as we went along, they found an astigmatization, so I wound up with surgery for that. I have been just amazed at what all these new findings are. I watched my grandmother go blind because her doctor said she was too far gone to have cataract surgery. And to be able to keep my vision, yes, I have to monitor it. And yes, I do my eye drops just like you, Larry. I have an eye drop in the morning. I have two at night. But to be able to see is, I'd do darn near anything. I can't do a headstand very well, but I'd figure out how if that's what I had to do.
Well, and I expect that's the kind of result and comment that you guys are commonly hear. At least I hope.
Yeah, I think it's when organizations do large inquiries about what is it in your health that you fear the most. Cancer always comes out number one, and blindness always comes out number two. Just like we want to take care of our bodies and try to prevent us developing cancer, doing everything we possibly can to maintain the health of our eyes is super important. And really the focus of what we do here at UW is you always want to keep what you've got. You don't want to have to replace what you've lost. So we want to be able to develop treatments for the whole spectrum. So to help your eyes stay healthy, to slow or prevent or stop disease once it's started, and then to reverse it if at all possible. And we're working on all those approaches.
Tom emailed us. He's been diagnosed with Drusen eye. What causes it, and how do you take care of it?
Oh, the scary drusen. So drusen by itself, I'm assuming this means he's talking about retinal drusen. Those are deposits of material that occur deep within the retina that if you look it up, we'll say can be a harbinger of macular degeneration. But depending on what type of drusen it is and how many you have, it's a natural extension of aging to some degree as well. So having just a few drusen here and there is nothing to get terribly worked up about. I mean, should you stay healthy? Should you make sure you get good exercise? Stop smoking. Number one, don't smoke. That's a huge risk factor for the progression of macular degeneration. Then you're probably doing fine. Now, if you have thousands of them and they start to grow together and coalesce, then that can be more serious. Just because you're told you have drusen, it's not the end of the world. Again, devil's in the details. So ask more questions when you're told that, whoever does tell you that. What does that mean? How many do I have? Because none of us want, as physicians, none of us want you to go home with the wrong idea of how, you know, we want you to take the serious thing serious, but we also want you to have a right size understanding so that you're not worrying, because stress isn't good for you either. So follow up with those questions about, you know, what does this mean for me? What should I be doing? And hopefully a lot of folks will have lost sleep.
And Mark in Sun Prairie, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Larry and guests. Thanks. Quick one. At a recent Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, there were a couple of products that were presented. Essentially, they're glasses that help to alleviate macular degeneration by giving vision, improving the vision on the periphery, which then helps to get rid of that dark spot. There were two glasses in particular that were presented. Do the doctors know anything about these types of products or this technology? And is there anywhere else they could recommend I would be able to look for more of this?
I can take this one as well, too. So the answer is yes.
Dr. Gann, go ahead.
We know a lot about this. And we have specialists within the Department of Ophthalmology, Sanbrita Mandal. We have a whole low vision group that is very knowledgeable about devices that are available to help folks who are waiting for treatments and are looking to technology to optimize the vision that they do have. We also have the Wisconsin Council for the Blind and Visually Impaired, which serves the entire state, which is one of the best in the nation, if not the best. I'm a bit biased, but I think they're the best. And they also have a great knowledge of devices as they come out, and smartphones and all these different types of glasses. It's important to know, though, that when you're commercially selling anything, you're always going to kind of stretch the truth a little bit. You want people to buy things, and so there's truth in there, but there's always a little bit of hyperbole to watch out for too. You cannot eliminate the central scotoma, so the part of your retina that's gone, no pair of glasses is going to make that come back and work. So what they're trying to do is magnify things and put things off to the periphery of your retina. But have you ever tried to read something? If you don't have macular degeneration, hold a piece of paper even just a few inches away from the center part of your vision and try to read it. You can't, because our retinas are not set up to be able to see high acuity vision except in the very center called the fovea, which is a small 1 by 1 millimeter area. It's probably the most expensive real estate in your entire body. And so when that's gone, you're limited. And so these devices help you in many respects, but they don't eliminate the underlying problem.
And on that note, boy, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much, not only for being with us today, Dr. Gammon, Dr. Nichols, but for the work you're doing. It's just fantastic work. And I guess I won't be able to use that test question anymore about... because too many people will know about it. Thank you both very much. Dr. David Gamm, Dr. Robert Nichols from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Gamm directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute. And sometime I hope we can get them back to talk more about the work that they're doing. And a big thanks to our group today. It's a team effort, as always. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store.